how to practice magic. Younger wizards in particular went about saying that it was time that magic started to update its image, and that they should all stop mucking about with bits of wax and bone and put the whole thing on a properly organized basis with research programs and 3-day conventions in good hotels where they could read papers with titles like Wither Geomancy and The Role of 7-League Boots in a Caring Society. Trumon, for example, hardly ever did any magic these days, but ran the order with hourglass efficiency and wrote lots of memos and had a big chart on his office wall covered with coloured blobs and flags and lines that no one else really understood, but which looked very impressive. The other type of wizard thought all this was so much marsh gas and wouldn't have anything to do with an image unless it was made of wax and had pins stuck in it. The heads of the 8 orders were all of this persuasion, traditionalists to a mage, and the utensils that were heaped around the octagram had a definite no-nonsense occult look about them. Ram's horns, skulls, baroque metalwork, and heavy candles were much in evidence, despite the discovery by younger wizards that the rite of Ashk-Enti could perfectly well be performed with 3 small bits of wood and 4 cubic centimetres of mouse blood. The preparations normally took several hours, but the combined powers of the senior wizards shortened it considerably, and after a mere 40 minutes, Golda chanted the final words of the spell. They hung in front of him for a moment before dissolving. The air in the centre of the octagram shimmered and thickened, and suddenly contained a tall, dark figure. Most of it was hidden by a black robe and hood, and this was probably just as well. It had a long scythe in one hand, and one couldn't help noticing that what should have been fingers was simply white bone. The other skeletal hand held small cubes of cheese and pineapple on a stick.
"Well,"
said Death, in a voice with all the warmth and colour of an iceberg. He caught the wizard's gaze and glanced down at the stick.
"I was at a party,"
he added, a shade reproachfully.
"O creature of earth and darkness, we do charge thee to abjure from—"
began Golda in a firm, commanding voice. Death nodded.
"Yes, yes, I know all that. Why have you summoned me?"
"It is said that you can see both the past and the future,"
said Golda, a little sulkily, because the big speech of binding and conjuration was one he rather liked, and people said he was very good at it.
"That is absolutely correct."
"Then perhaps you can tell us what exactly it was that happened this morning," said Golda.
He pulled himself together and added loudly,
"I command this by Azimrotha, by T'Chikel, by—"
"All right, you've made your point. What precisely was it you wished to know? Quite a lot of things happened this morning. People were born, people died, all the trees grew a bit taller, ripples made an interesting pattern on the sea."
"I mean about the octavo," said Golda coldly.
"That? Oh, that was just a readjustment of reality. I understand the octavo was anxious not to lose the 8th spell. It was dropping off the disc, apparently."
Hold on, said Golda. He scratched his chin. "Are we talking about the one inside the head of Rincewind? Tall, thin man? Bit scraggy? The one—"
"That he has been carrying around all these years, yes."
Golda frowned. It seemed a lot of trouble to go to. Everyone knew that when a wizard died, all the spells in his head would go free, so why bother to save Rincewind? The spell would just float back eventually.
"Any idea why?"
he said, without thinking, and then remembering himself in time, added hastily,
"By Iripf and K'Charla, I do abjure thee, and—"
"I wish you wouldn't keep doing that. All that I know is that all the spells have to be set together next Hogswatch night, or the disc will be destroyed."
"Speak up there,"
demanded Greyhound Spold.
"Shut up," said Golda.
"Me?"
"No, him, daft old—"
"I heard that," snapped